So welcome to this, the latest EuroPAM interview. And today we're interviewing Dr. Mars Pattenden, who is the director of the core program at the EuroPAM, soon to be rebranded the Ideas Program. Good afternoon, Mars.
Good afternoon, Anthony.
So you've been on board for a couple of years now. I mean, tell us a bit about yourself. I mean, how did you come to do this job? You're obviously a distinguished historian in your own right. And have particularly been quite prominent in the last year or so over papal history. But tell us a bit about yourself and your background and how and why you're in Oxford at this stage.
Well, thank you very much for those kind words, Anthony. As you've just said, I'm a historian of the papacy and the Catholic Church originally in the 16th century and now increasingly encompassing the whole of the last 2,000 years of Christianity. I've had a very active year, as many of you can imagine, because of the death of Pope Francis and the conclave that elected Pope Leo. But I've been in Oxford on and off now for about 20 years. I came here as a graduate student after some time at Cambridge and in Toronto in Canada. I'm a joint British and Australian citizen. But the focus of my academic work has always been, up until now, Italy. I studied here for a DPhil, and then I was also here for a postdoc. I was on the faculty for a few years. And now for the last 2 years, I've been in this job at the EuroPAM, kind of building on my expertise and commitment to European history and European studies. And so far, it's been very exciting.
And what attracted you to working in the EuroPAM, and what do you think its distinctive qualities are as an alliance of universities?
I think I've always been attracted to working beyond Britain. Even when I was an undergraduate and we were thinking where to do our honours dissertations, a lot of people were going to the National Archives in Kew or public record offices and so on. And I thought, no, I want to do something more than that. And I went to Rome. And I wrote a dissertation originally on Clara of Assisi. That sense that it's important to study other cultures has always been ingrained in me, perhaps also because, you know, my background is to come from two of them that sometimes seem similar but often seem very different as well. I spend a lot of time as a graduate student in Italy and also in Spain. I was lucky enough to have a sabbatical year there in the 2010s as well. So, you know, this my work at the EuroPAM has been building on that and on the sense that actually it's very important to foster a European level community of scholars who can think about how our practices and engagement with ideas is similar but also different around different parts of Europe, and what are the pros and cons of the different intellectual traditions and the way in which we translate pure research into policy.
You mentioned in that context, you mentioned both academic research and policy, and that seems to be a distinctive feature of the way the EuroPAM has evolved, which is that it's both about trying to encourage kind of academic cross-fertilisation across national boundaries, across disciplines and so on, but also to strengthen the interface between that world and what you might call the practitioner world of policy and of trying to shape, in inverted commas, as the founding mandate of the EuroPAM has it, Europe for the better. And how in that sort of process has the core programme, as it's been called up to now, has that fitted as part of a strategy for trying to strengthen that interface and also try and encourage new skills and leadership capabilities for the future?
Well, the core programme is one of the EuroPAM, one of the oldest parts of the EuroPAM's offering. It goes back, I think, to one way or another to the original mission, and I first encountered it I think more than 10 years ago when I was on the faculty and I supervised some dissertations within the EuroPAM. The basic idea of it has always been to get academics like me or our graduate student equivalents to think, well, how actually can we translate the kind of work we're doing into concrete real world scenarios that have some impact, how do we make them relevant to the kind of questions that people are asking outside of the university. And of course, the policy world is the most obvious of those things. But a lot of the ideas and a lot of the things that we talk about can also be translated into wider kinds of public debate that go on all the time on all kinds of issues. And they're reflected in the kinds of events that we now organize. But at the same time, we're trying to do sort of the reverse or the inverse of that and say, well, actually, a lot of policy formation and formulation at European level, but also at national level. I mean, it can be slightly divorced from the kinds of deep thinking that goes on in a lot of our member universities. And so it's also very important, for students who are thinking about going into that world, or perhaps who are doing professional degrees oriented towards that world, that they also sort of think, well, we've got to step back and see this in a broader intellectual context. So the nexus of the core program, as it were, has always been to try and get these two groups of students and academics together and to talk to each other and to think about, how their world can be improved by exposure to the other one, as it were.
Yes, and I mean, my impression, but correct me if I'm wrong, is that this interface is becoming a bit more complicated. I mean, on the one hand, perhaps fewer master students and particularly fewer doctoral students are actually going into the world of academia at the end of their studies. But conversely, and again, perhaps I misunderstand this, but my sense is that the worlds of academia and practice have been somewhat drifting apart. That's been partly to do with academia itself, which has become increasingly specialized and rather introverted. And at the same time, you've got the problem that the world of policy practice is becoming increasingly skeptical of expertise and is being increasingly driven by factors which don't seem to be entirely rational. And so the interface of trying to connect policy practice and the world of theory, reflection, and research is becoming rather more disjointed. So the Europeans' aspirations are particularly important in that context, but also perhaps more and more challenging, put it that way.
Yes, I think that's right. The EuropaEM is one of a relatively small number of organizations that operates in this space and tries to get the two groups together in dialogue. As you say, one of the problems is that academics now are increasingly specialized in their work, and also that the metrics by which they're accountable to universities tend to disfavor the kind of public engagement that really we are looking to foster and which we see value in. On the other hand, we mustn't always be guided purely by those kind of internal bureaucratic mechanisms within universities. And that's why, it's so important that organizations like the EuropaEM continue to survive. At the same time, there are other problems in the policy world, which I'm less expert in, but I can see one of these is that there's a constant demand for novelty, a constant demand for initiatives, for doing things, for being out there, for talking. And that the problem with that is that you don't actually have time to stop and think about what you're saying. So one of the ways in which the EuropaEM is adding something, particularly for master's students who are interested in that, in developing careers in that space, is that they have time in our events to sort of sit and think, what's the context? How might we employ the resources of something like history to think about a problem which seems very current, within the different institutions that we're looking at, but actually, it has a longer history. We're not going to solve this issue in the next 5 minutes because it's actually been there for 1,000 years, that kind of thing.
And so, how do you structure the content, not just the subjects, but the actual sort of modus operandi, the way, the reality of the meetings and events that you hold in the core program to try to capture some of this and make sure that students get the best of what's available in that type of interaction?
Well, we try to be as flexible as possible in the events that we have, and each one is designed bespoke for the particular circumstances in which it arises. And by that I mean both, where it's taking place, what university it is at, and therefore what resources are available in the locality, but also, the context of the subject. Not all topics and themes require the same kind of resources, but we are always looking to get some kind of balance between the different components that go into our events and that make the EuropaEM what it is. So one of these obviously is the practitioner versus academic distinction, and we always have a mix both of policymakers and more academic speakers. We like to get a mix of student speakers and kind of more experienced speakers as well, and in general, I try and put them on combined panels so that, to some extent, that they can learn from each other. The older speakers can see the enthusiasm of the students, but the students can also see upfront, how more experienced people craft their interventions in these areas. And you also get meaningful dialogue then at the end of those panels, through the joint discussions that emerge from them. We have lectures as well. Sometimes we have interactive workshops. But the aim is to get people together from different backgrounds and from different areas of Europe. And that's one of the key things that all the EuropaAIMS programs have always added, this sense that, actually by bringing people together from different places with different traditions, you can see how similar studies are done differently elsewhere, and that can have a value for helping you reflect on the way in which you're doing your own work.
Now, for those who are not experts or haven't actually participated in any of the EuropaIM core or ideas to be future in the Future Ideas Programme activities, just tell us a bit about how characteristically they operate. I mean, how long are they? How many of them are there? How many people participate? Which are the venues that are used for them across Europe and so on?
Well, at the moment, we run between 8 and 10 EuropaIM core or ideas events each year, and they have a variable range of students depending on the context and what we're putting on. The larger ones, the four flagship schools that we run in winter, spring, summer, and autumn, they have between 25 and 35, perhaps even 40 students at them, and they usually take place at one of our member universities. The spring school often is here in Oxford. The autumn one is in Brussels and focuses on European Union policy issues. But we also have a number of smaller events which rotate in locations of interest, often in member universities, but not always. Sometimes, they'll have a smaller number of students, which reflects the fact that they are more targeted and focused in particular areas. And often they engage topics which seem particularly timely, the kind of things, where we feel the need for some kind of discussion because there is an initiative going on, which needs to be reflected on, and where there's an opportunity for students to learn.
I see that in the relaunch and rebranding of this as the European Ideas Programme, as you say, there are four seasonal schools: spring, summer, autumn, winter. There are two to four other flagship events on a whole range of different themes, which can be chosen: classics, colloquium, history seminar, leadership challenge, futures forum, popular culture forum, technology seminar. And then there are the possibility of associated or partnership events, either with individual universities who are members of the European or with think tanks. And that, in fact, in the course of 2026, there's going to be the development of a partnership with CEPS, the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels, which is obviously one of the leading think tanks. So that's an awful lot of bases to cover. Tell us, I mean, in deciding on the composition of the 2026 offering, first of all, what kind of balance are you striking? And secondly, what's coming up and that people who are listening to this might be, especially students, might be interested in attending?
Well, we have a balance between events which are primarily focused towards policy and others which are more reflective and which try to bring in a more academic perspective on the issues. But all of them, have this dual approach. As you've said, the 2026 calendar is going to start with a workshop in Lisbon at the Catholic University of Portugal, which is on media and courage. This is an event that we now have each year, which is effectively focused on media studies and communications. Then we have the Winter School taking place at Central European University in Vienna, which is on scandal and corruption. And this is our flagship event in the kind of political economy space. We have a number of speakers coming there from CEU and beyond who work in economics departments, law, political science, and so on. We have the Spring School in Oxford, which this year is on transatlantic futures and thinking about the relationship between European societies and those on the other side of the pond, as we call it here. We have a summer school on creativity and innovation that's taking place in Krakow in Poland, and the autumn school in Brussels. And we have a number of other smaller events to which you've already alluded, a very exciting one coming up in the autumn on space. and space policy, which will happen in Helsinki. We have a leadership challenge in Berlin in May. We have a joint history and classics seminar in Munich in September, which looks at the theme of decolonization. We're participating in two other associated events, the Ideas Forum of the SEPS think tank in Brussels in March, and in June, the Estoril Political Forum, which is organised by the Catholic University of Portugal, and looks at international relations.
Well, that's a fantastic offering, and any students who are listening from any of the member universities of the EuroPem should note their diaries and try and apply to participate in one or other of these events if they've got the time. We're almost out of time on our 15 minutes conversation, but before we close, I wanted to ask you a very particular question, which is, as you sort of alluded to earlier on, you have a certain expertise in papal politics and papal elections historically. Can you tell the people listening here how accurate was the film Conclave in its reflection of the way papal elections actually occur?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because when I first reviewed it, I said, the idea of an American pope, that's completely crazy. And then just 6 months later, we have one. I mean, I enjoyed the film greatly. The main thing to note from it was that, the visuals were stunning. I wondered if the politicking was strictly accurate, that I think cardinals, are better at keeping these things less dramatic. But then in the end, in May 2025, we had a conclave which was every bit as dramatic as the film itself was. So, perhaps this is a moment to reflect on the limits of expertise rather than to talk about how well I did about it.
And do you think that the fact it's all held behind closed doors and in total secrecy, or at least ostensibly in secrecy, adds to the authority of the Pope emerging from the conclave process?
Well, I think it makes it a lot easier for him because, as we've seen with all kinds of secular political leaders, if everybody knows that you only won that party vote by one vote, you have a lot less authority than when you have a landslide. So, there are reasons why this culture of secrecy emerged in Rome, and that is a subject that I've written about quite a lot in my research.
Thank you very much indeed, Miles.
Thank you.